Good morning and welcome to the July 27th episode of Mountain Money. I'm Kevin Kennedy, your co-host. I'll be joined by Roger Goldman, our other co-host, in just a few minutes. We have a great show for you this morning. We'll speak with author Liaquette Ahmed about his new book, 1873, The Rothschilds, The First Great Depression, and the Making of the Modern World. It's a deep dive into the mostly unknown global financial crisis of 1873. Stay with us. We'll be right back after we pay some bills.
It was a frothy time in the markets, when they seemed to have nowhere to go but up. Ordinary, middle-class people invested in stocks, often with borrowed money. Look, I'm not talking about the dot-com boom in the late 90s. I'm talking about the early 1870s and the panic of 1873. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Liaquette Ahmed takes us deep into the reasons for and the impact of what happened in 1873 in his new book, 1873, The Rothschilds, The First Great Depression, and the Making of the Modern World. We are very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So first question, what motivated me? I wrote a book about the 1929 Great Depression about 15 years ago, found financial crises quite fascinating, not because I'm sort of a misanthrope who enjoys watching mass suffering, but just because it's the one time as an economic historian that you get a lot of action in a short period of time, and history speeds up. You know, most times as an economic historian, things play out over years, even decades, whereas in a financial crisis, what typically takes a decade happens in a few months. There is a lot of drama, and it's a little bit the way military historians like to write about war. Financial historians like to write about crises.
Kind of like economic train wrecks. They're kind of fun to watch.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure I quite like that analogy.
Okay, so how long did it take?
You know, embarrassingly too long, for two reasons. One is I started it before COVID in 2018. And during COVID, it was hard to concentrate. So some writers found it great to be able to concentrate. And I found it hard to concentrate and to be motivated when, you know, people were dying around the world to think, you know, I'm going to write a book. So that sort of intervened. That was the main reason it took so long.
Well, is there another reason, which is I was reading the book and you're talking about events that happened in Egypt and events that happened in all these places around Vienna. I would have thought that the research materials, the actual underlying source materials, would be scattered all around the world, which would present another challenge.
You know, most of the material, the way I write, I don't actually go to the source material very much.
Okay.
Because, you know, lots of PhD students have been burrowing in the archives and writing theses. What they don't typically do, so they go, you know, 6 inches wide and a mile deep. And I wanted a narrative that went maybe not 6 inches deep, but, you know, a foot deep and a mile wide. And as you said, it covers a lot of territory. So crafting a narrative that went across the world from, you know, Egypt through Central Europe, through London, Paris, into the far west of the United States, it was hard to craft that narrative. And I have this terrible tendency to go down rabbit holes. I'm lucky to have a wonderful editor who would drag me out of the rabbit holes and say, you know, get back to the story.
So your previous book was Lords of Finance, about the 29 crash.
Why do you think the panic of 1873 has faded from public memory while 1929 remains, you know, iconic?
You know, 1929 resulted in true mass suffering. You got mass unemployment, you know, the scenes of the bread lines and people, you know, people auctioning off cars. And so that it was, whereas 1873, after a period of mass suffering, the period of mass suffering was relatively short. What happened, though, was that it started a process of declining prices. And for 20 years, prices declined. A little bit like Japan since the 1990 crash. And that results not so much in mass suffering as in a redistribution of income from people who borrow money to people who own financial assets. And that leads to a sort of a very fractured political atmosphere rather than mass suffering. So the effect is quite pernicious, but it occurs over a long period of time. So the result of 1873 was very long lasting, but not quite so, you know, not quite so impactful on the working man.
You know, I was reading in the first part of the book, your stories about how the markets were going, you know, up in the late 1860s and early 1870s. Talk a little bit about how widespread public involvement was with the purchase of, you know, stocks and bonds. That's not something we usually think of as happening in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually the first era when middle-class people got involved in financial markets. Now, there'd been a I would distinguish between what happened in Europe and what happened in the U.S. Mm-hmm. In Europe, you got in particularly Central Europe, in Germany and Austria, you got a stock market bubble where stocks started climbing massively. The stock market doubled in a period of 2 years. The total value of there were lots of IPOs. The total value of the stock market quadrupled in 2 years. And everyone got involved, you know, essentially ranging from dukes and duchesses to shoeshine boys and ladies' maids. So it was there was sort of a mass frenzy. In the U.S., it was much... it was actually much more rational and sedate because it was mainly mainly in the bond market. And only upper middle class people bought bonds. So it didn't become a frenzy, nonetheless, you got some very poor investments. From 1871 to 73, 500 new railroad companies were formed. And, you know, there was just not enough profit for 500 new railroad companies. You know, there wasn't enough of a market for them to make money. Many of them were in the West, which is essentially west of Chicago in those days. There weren't enough population centers to provide them enough traffic. So that showed up not so much in a frenzy of buying as much as making investments in railroad companies' bonds, which then had trouble servicing those bonds. A little bit like the real estate bubble that occurred in 2008. So that, I mean, that was the difference. But it, so it varied between the U.S. and Europe.
And now, weren't the railroads in the U.S. having a problem because they thought they could, the Native American people there, but they were putting up a good fight out in the West and they couldn't get to the mining areas?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, that was part of the story. The other part of the story was they relied heavily on federal government subsidies. So when the first Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1869, it had cost about $70 million, of which $30 million had come from the federal government in the form of land grants and outright debt subsidies. In 1872, it became apparent that because of this, there had been mass corruption. There was a scandal called Credit Mobilier in 1872, where it was discovered that dozens of congressmen had been taking bribes from the sponsors of the railroads. And this had been channeled through a company that was a shell company designed, owned by the sponsors, designed to finance the construction at excessively high prices. So it was, the corruption was rife. I mean, it really was an era of mass corruption. And when that hit the press in 1872, Congress was forced to stop providing money.
Mm-hmm.
So the Northern Pacific, which was the railroad that was being the second transcontinental railroad, wasn't able to count on federal subsidies because Congress just closed its wallet. And as a consequence, they ran out of money halfway through construction.
So I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you about why you concluded that the Rothschilds were the ideal lens through which to tell the story of 1873 and the years beyond.
The main reason is they provided a window into what financiers of that era were like and the massive, massive amounts of money that financiers were able to make. I mean, in 1873, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world. And they were worth the equivalent today of $200 billion. Wow. Now that doesn't, that's not quite Elon Musk sort of money, but it's getting up there. And the fact that they were able to do this, not by building anything, but just by being intermediaries and providing and connecting savers with investment opportunities said something about that era, that it was an era dominated by financiers and bankers. The second is that they were the first transnational financial enterprise. I mean, they straddled five of the major countries in Europe. Interestingly enough, they didn't have a branch in the U.S. Because they got involved during the canal boom, had lost money, and had been outraged when they couldn't sue their debtors because most of the canal boom was fueled by states, and the states claimed sovereign immunity. And so, the individual states, so Tennessee and, all of those states. And, the Rothschilds thought this is crazy, a system where you can't go and try and sue the people who owe you money. And so they had withdrawn from the U.S. They did have an agent who became very prominent, and Auguste Belmont, who's you know, a well-known person. But they didn't actually, none of the Rothschilds moved to the United States, and they only trusted the family.
Yeah, take us down one layer. Like, what did, you know, how was this multinational Rothschild group organized across the many countries, and how did they work together?
Okay, so there was a founder who was in Frankfurt, and he had five sons. And in the just before 1800, he sent his third son to London, because he'd accumulated a lot of pounds sterling, because he was the banker to the Hessian prince. And if you remember, during this the American War of Independence, the British had relied on Hessian soldiers, and so he'd accumulated a lot of cash that he'd got from during the American War of Independence, and he wanted to invest it properly. So he sent his son to London to go into the textile business, his third son. Instead, his third son decided to become a smuggler. And Napoleon had blockaded Britain, and the third son devised a way of avoiding the blockade and made a ton of money, essentially providing the British with a way of avoiding the Napoleonic blockade. And he had four other brothers who were based in Europe, and he used that network to evade, you know, the French blockade. After the Napoleonic Wars were over, the five brothers spanned out across Europe. So one in London, one in Frankfurt, one in Vienna, one in Paris, and one in Naples. And they essentially became, they first made their money lending, acting as an intermediaries, and raising money for the princes of Europe and governments of Europe to reconstruct after the Napoleonic Wars. Because don't forget, the Napoleonic Wars had been a 20-year world war. And they made a ton of money financing the initially governments. Then in 1848, you get a revolution, you get revolutions across Europe. The Rothschilds actually almost went bankrupt because of that, because suddenly everyone faced the prospect that every government in Europe, apart from Britain, was going to be overturned. And, you know, who knows who would pay, you know, would they pay off their debts? Luckily, they were able to stay, you know, the princes stepped back in and reestablish control. But the Rothschilds then moved into financing infrastructure. And they said, okay, the government bond business is over. Reconstruction, we've completed reconstruction. Let's go into the business of financing railroads and ports and, you know, all forms of communication. And they controlled 60% of the international bond market. And that took them from being, they were already very rich, but that took them to being the richest bankers in the world. They were also very, very careful about husbanding their capital. So of these five, the five brothers had 11 grandsons. Now, they would only allow grandsons to go into the business. So the daughters were given a dowry and then packed off. The son-in-laws couldn't join the business. So only the direct descendants. They went actually a step further, which is that of the 11 grandsons, 10 married their first cousins. So this was a way of keeping the capital in the family. It sounds weird to our modern ears, but don't forget, in the 19th century, marrying your first cousin was actually not such an unusual thing. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were first cousins. Most of the royal family, royal families of Europe married each other. Now, I'm not sure that's a good recommendation. But, you know, Charles Darwin married his first cousin. Albert Einstein married his first cousin. So, you know, it was more common than it is today. So that allowed them to husband their capital and not dissipate it.
You know, as we go through the book, and probably won't get to this right now, but a number of times you point to how wise they were in terms of what they chose to invest in and what they rejected as being too risky. I want to get to the actual panic of 1873. What actually triggered it, and why did a banking crisis in Vienna spread so fast?
Yeah, so from 1870 to 1873, in 1870, there was the Franco-Prussian War, and that disrupted capital markets across Europe. Now, you would have thought disrupting capital markets is not a good thing. Instead, it unleashed all these mass capital flows, which went into strange areas. So the London Stock Exchange became almost like a casino. There was mass amount of money that went into the U.S., into U.S. railroads, because the U.S. was away from Europe and sort of, if you like, protected from the turmoil in Europe. And within Europe, France had to pay $1 billion in reparations to Germany, which then caused a stock market bubble in Berlin and Vienna. So so you've got these bubbles forming all over the place, all originating with the disruptions in the capital markets in 1870. The most pronounced bubble was actually in Austria and Vienna. The stock market went up 300% in 3 years. We got hundreds of new companies being formed. And then by 1873, people had realized that this had gone too far. In May of 1873, you had this surreal scene because the emperor's daughter was getting married. And all of the royal families of Europe had collected in Vienna to celebrate Princess Elizabeth's marriage. And so you had the surreal scene of the stock market, you know, being at the highs, everyone worrying about whether they were paying too much for companies that they knew nothing about, and the royal families of Europe celebrating. And in May of 1873, you got a rumor that Anselm von Rothschild, who was the richest man in Austria, was selling was actually going short. He hadn't bought, but he had decided the stock market had gone too high. And at that point, everyone panicked. And, you know, no one can always, you know, you can never identify why stocks suddenly start collapsing. You know, in 2000, why did the market suddenly decide in March of 2000 that, wow, we've taken this way too high, and then you get a crash? So in May, you got a crash. Bank stocks, which were the leading part of the stock market, went down 45% in a single day.
Oh, wow.
And that's, you know, that created a wave of panic in Austria. And then you got this sort of interlude of calm Yeah. Initially, people had thought, well, this, you know, this is going to have massive repercussions around the world. And for a couple of months, there were no repercussions. And everyone then went back to saying, you know, maybe this was, you know, an Austrian thing, a Viennese thing. And, you know, we'll go back to business as usual. Then in September, you got the announcement that the Northern Pacific, being led by Jay Cook, who was the premier investment banker in the U.S., a friend of the president's, who had raised $2 billion for the Union government during the Civil War, he announces that he is unable to raise the capital to complete the Northern Pacific. Now, this would be like, I don't know, Sam Altman declaring that he can't complete the OpenAI model, and he's run out of money. You know, it caused panic because they said, look, if Jay Cook can't raise the money, then, you know, I've got a small railroad company in the Midwest. What hope do I have of raising money? And in Europe, Europeans who had invested in U.S. railroad bonds said, God, you know, who knows whether my railroad company is able to pay its dividends. So there was mass panic, and that transmitted across the world.
So that's how it got to the U.S., the Northern Pacific.
The Northern Pacific.
You know,
and for the reasons that we talked about, the war with the Indians and the corruption and not being able to raise the capital through Congress.
We often hear that the original actions of various governments in the 1930s tended to prolong the downturn. Let's talk a little bit about how governments in the U.S. and in Europe reacted to the crisis and whether they made things worse and what tools they might have been able to deploy had they been able to figure it out.
Yeah. Governments in the 19th century didn't see it as their responsibility to stabilize the economy. You know, they thought the economy would go up and down, and it was outside their control. Central banks did view their role as making sure that you didn't get lots of banks going under. So they would step in and lend in emergencies to banks that were facing trouble. In 1873, we actually had a separate problem, which is in a financial crisis, geopolitics does not take a vacation. Countries are always trying to get one up on each other. And in 1873, in the middle of a financial crisis, Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor of Germany, having defeated France on the battlefield, decides, I'm going to hit them while they're down, and I'm going to destroy their financial system. And the French were the linchpins of a system which relied on both gold and silver. They were the global linchpins of the bimetallic system. And by what Otto von Bismarck did was he took the money that he'd got from France and used it to sell all his silver and convert it into gold. And that drove silver prices down. Now, it turned out to be totally self-defeating because Germany got hurt. But his calculation was, I'm going to hurt France even more. But what instead happened was that every bank in Europe, and it was mainly a European bank affair at this point, started bailing out of silver, and silver prices collapsed. Because the world, so much of the world was based on silver, there was this sharp, there was this frantic panic and accumulation and a sort of hoarding of gold. Now, whenever in the 19th century you got hoarding of gold, that caused credit to tighten. And that happened across the world. And we got essentially a sharp contraction in credit in the middle of a financial crisis. Now, maybe the world could have withstood it if you didn't have, at the same time, mass panic going on. But with no safe asset, or the only safe asset being gold, everyone sort of, you know, just dumps everything to accumulate gold, which caused commodity prices to go down by 30% in 1873 alone. They would eventually go down by 50% over the next 20 years. You got prices falling systematically for 20 years. And it was all because of Bismarck's decision to bail out of silver.
And what was going on in terms of the U.S. and its relationship to its currency, to gold and silver?
Okay, the U.S. faced a little bit of a dilemma because it had got taken itself off gold and silver during the Civil War.
Right.
You know, as all countries used to do, that if you want to finance the Civil War, you can't be worrying about, maintaining the value of your currency against gold and silver. In 1865, it decided that it was going to go back onto gold and silver at that point. But it, was going to go back onto gold because there had been so much, the discoveries of gold had been so large that they did a calculation and said, you know, there's so much gold in the world. Why do we need to worry about silver? And the British are on gold. Why don't we just copy the British and go on to gold? And so they had taken the decision that they were going to go on to gold. And they set a date of 1879 when they were going to go back on to gold. The president, who by this time was Ulysses Grant, faced a dilemma. His long-run goal was to return to gold and reestablish the dollar as a serious currency, which involved keeping money tight for the next 5 or 6 years. On the other hand, the stock market had just collapsed. Railroad companies were defaulting, and that didn't seem like a good time to keep money tight. And in Congress, there was a bill passed, which became known as the Inflation Bill, which essentially said, let's just delay returning to gold. And this put Grant in a real dilemma. He sat up overnight trying to resolve, do I want to stick to my long-run goal of returning to gold and reestablishing the dollar as a serious currency? Or do I want to respond to the exigencies of the moment and ease monetary policy and delay returning to gold? And he ended up choosing the former and essentially keeping money tight. So all the bankers were thrilled and, you know, they wrote letters to the press saying, you know, he saved the U.S. currency. But anyone who borrowed money became very upset. And in the process, he split the Republican Party, because the Republican Party at that point was a coalition of Eastern rich folk and Western farmers and miners, and actually also, relatively little in the South. And he split the Republican Party in the middle, which would have massive political repercussions for the Republicans and for politics in the U.S. But, you know, he made his choice. It meant that commodity prices also fell in the U.S., and we got waves of foreclosures of farmers in the West.
Hi, this is Dr. Mari Leining, CEO at the People's Health Clinic. Join us on Sunday, August 9th, for Walk and Wine at Stein Erickson Lodge in Deer Valley. It's a morning of hiking and yoga, an afternoon of wine and community, with every ticket supporting free care for uninsured neighbors across the Wasatch Back. Register at peopleshealthclinic.org. People's Health Clinic is a proud supporter of KPCW.
Join us Fridays at 9 a.m. for the Community Campfire, KPCW's podcast featuring the voices of the Wasatch Back. This week, Amber Johnson brings us the story of a Wasatch high school graduate who had the artistic opportunity of a lifetime, helping to create a masterful replica of the Gates of Paradise. Coach Skinner returns with Skinny on Sports, sharing insights and musings on local sports and beyond, and will welcome indie surf rock band Rally live in the studio before they take the stage Friday night at Kilby Court. The Community Campfire, your community, your voices.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with author Liaquat Ahmed and his new book, 1873, The Rothschilds, the First Great Depression, and the Making of the Modern World.
You had mentioned the contraction of credit and just now the commodity prices dropping, you know, in Europe and then in the U.S. How did that affect workers, farmers, and industry in general?
You know, when commodity prices go down, or generally prices go down, if you've borrowed money, you face increasing trouble servicing your debts. On the other hand, if you're a bondholder and, you know, you're a rich person in Boston and you own bonds or any sort of financial asset, probably not stocks, but, you know, you own government bonds, as prices go down, they rise in value. So you've created a schism in society between creditors and borrowers. And the borrowers were typically farmers and industrialists, and they faced increasing problems throughout the 1870s and 1880s. Meanwhile, bankers were feeling very pleased with themselves. The result was actually became most apparent in politics. Because in 1873, you get this crash. In 1874, I mean, it looked as if in 1872, the Republicans looked as if they were going to dominate the political scene for the next generation, two generations. They controlled the presidency. In the 1872 presidential election, the Democrats hadn't even fielded a candidate. The two candidates were Ulysses Grant, the sitting president, and a so-called liberal Republican, Horace Greeley. So the Republicans controlled the House, they controlled the Senate. It looked as if they would dominate politics. In 1874, because of Grant's decision to keep money tight and the split in the Republican Party, the Republicans lose the House in the largest ever swing, or the second largest ever swing in the House in history. That was followed in 1876 by the Republicans almost losing the presidency. They lost the popular vote. They also came close to losing the vote in the Electoral College and were only able to retain power, retain the presidency by a backroom deal that Republicans in and Democrats did in Congress, where they said, the Democrats said, okay, we will give you the presidency, because there were three states where there was great dispute about the Electoral College. It was a bit like 2020. We will give you the presidency. But in return, we want a pledge that you, as once the Republicans take over the presidency, and Rutherford Hayes was going to be the president, you withdraw all federal troops from the South, which would essentially mean the end of Reconstruction, any attempt by the federal government to impose sort of civil rights in the South, and the beginning of democratic resurgence in the South. And it's not hard to trace a line from there to the rise of Jim Crow laws. So it had massive political implications for how the U.S. would evolve politically.
I think we could do an entire show on the 1876 election, which is actually one of my favorite stories. It has wonderful images of Zachariah Chandler getting on a train with a suitcase full of money. Just the stories from 1876 are endless. But it's only part of this story. I found the discussion about Egypt and the role that the British government played there particularly interesting. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what happened there and how the British exerted their influence?
Okay, so you have the two countries that had borrowed the largest amount were Turkey, which had borrowed the Ottoman Empire, which had borrowed $1 billion, and Egypt, which had borrowed $500 million. And in both cases, the borrowing had gone into totally wasteful expenditures. The Ottoman Sultan had built, you know, lots of palaces. He'd become enamored with having a giant navy to take on the British Royal Navy. So, you know, there was the Ottoman Empire, you know, massively in debt, and he starts building dreadnoughts and trying to have the second largest navy in the world. Meanwhile, he was also gradually succumbing to mental instability. So he would only, he insisted his members of his court only write in red ink. He would ask them to prostrate themselves. He increasingly lost touch with reality. Egypt was the other country, which was also run by an Eastern potentate, as they called them in those days, and it was the king or the ruler of Egypt had actually had a very liberal education. He'd gone to school in Paris, wanted to emulate the French, thought that he would remake Cairo like Paris, build giant boulevards and, you know, lovely gardens, you know, and he's got his own sort of crazy notions. He builds himself also a 500-room palace. He has 14 wives and builds a palace for each one of them, which can house, you know, each of their entourages. He builds the longest private yacht in the world, which was the longest private yacht for the next 100 years.
Whoa.
He has his own problems. In 1875, they both default on their debts. In the case of Turkey, because the British needed the Ottoman Empire as a bulwark against the Russians to prevent the Russians getting to the Mediterranean, they were more lenient on the Ottomans. They forgave them half their debt, and even the other half they heavily discounted. So the Ottomans were able to negotiate, essentially because they were geopolitically very important. Egypt, not so much. And the Egyptians tried to negotiate a deal, and the British kept on insisting that they pay 100 cents on the dollar. They eventually conceded a bid and allowed them to pay only 80 cents or 90 cents on the dollar. There was outcry in Egypt. There was a attempt at a revolution. The ruler of Egypt was deposed and sent into exile. The British realized that they could not afford to have a revolution. And by this time, the Suez Canal had been built, and it was just too important to fall into hostile hands. So they invaded Egypt. And until then, there was a sort of there was a movement in Britain to sort of reduce British imperialism. You know, they had India, and they said, you know, we've got enough. We don't need to control the whole world. The invasion of Egypt sets off a whole second wave of British acquisition of territory in what became known as the Scramble for Africa. Britain's empire in Africa was acquired in the wake of the invasion of Egypt. Hmm. They then, once they were in Egypt, they were stuck because they could never, they always thought, well, we'll withdraw from Egypt because we don't really want to run Egypt. That's too big a country to run. But it was, they always feared the political instability that would arise if they withdrew. So they felt compelled to stay, and they essentially stayed until the 1950s.
So the subtitle is the making of the modern world. In what ways did the crisis reshape history?
You know, I think three ways. The first is something that I have not talked about, but was the rise of anti-Semitism or a new form of anti-Semitism in Europe. That when the stock market bubble in Germany and Vienna imploded, everyone was looking for a scapegoat. And it was a time of real where everyone was trying to find someone to blame. They latched onto this rising community of Jewish merchants and financiers. So that was one. And until then, there'd been prejudice against Jews, there'd been laws against them, but they were gradually becoming emancipated. But now there was a new dimension, a totally new dimension, which was the economic dimension. So that was one. The second was what it did in the United States, which is essentially reestablish the Democratic Party in the South and leave a legacy of Jim Crow that would put back civil rights for 100 years. Thirdly, this rise of imperialism across the world. And, you know, these three forces would dominate history in all of these countries for the next 50 to 100 years.
I guess the other question I would have is, the Bank of England was forced to raise its rates to the highest level in a century during the 1873 crisis. How would you say, does that compare in any way to the interest rates environment that we saw in 2022 to 2026? And, you know, what do we learn about the lag between monetary tightening and economic damage?
You know, the Bank of England did tighten, but only because they were concerned about Britain. They did not view their role as, you know, being the central banker of the world. You know, no one had that role. They viewed their role as essentially worrying about British gold supply, and they were worried that whenever there was financial turmoil, gold would leave Britain. So that was the reason, and it was a very isolated thing, and it didn't really affect Britain very much. I thought you were going to ask about the Fed during 2008, when it reduced rates to zero and provided swap lines to every country, every major country in the world, swap lines, dollar swap lines, so essentially lent dollars, not only to its own banks, but to international banks. And that was a case of the Fed acting as the central bank to the rest of the world. And so I think we're in a very different environment. Now, the 2022 tightening, I think, was essentially the first step to the Fed deciding that it has taken too global a role. Mm-hmm. And we hear from Kevin Warsh, the new chairman of the Fed, that he wants to see a smaller footprint for the Fed. So I think if we do get another financial crisis, which we will, you will see a much less prominent role for the Fed going forward.
The book is 1873, The Rothschilds, The First Great Depression, and The Making of the Modern World. Thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
Well, thank you to both of you. This is fascinating.
We agree. We'll be right back after this.